Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become that you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio.
And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. So glad you could join us, coming to you live from southern Mississippi. Our AccuWindow forecast, 99 degrees. And about as much moisture as can possibly be held by the atmosphere. One sunspot out there, nothing real active to talk about. The solar wind, 459 kilometers per second. There will be some aurora activity in the northern climes. If you're up there, have a look tonight. It should be glorious. We want you to pay close attention tonight. We were on earlier tonight on the Crimson Pill program a couple of hours ago. And as luck would have it, I mean, just unbelievable synchronicity. The subject matter covered on that program was a primer for tonight's program of X Squared Radio. We started researching this about 6 days ago. Actually, we've been putting pieces together for quite a while. And of very recently, like in the last couple of days, some very incredible information has fallen into my hands relative to tonight's subject matter. It's so new that there isn't even any web activity on this yet. We are going to talk about Comet Elenin, but we're going to bring you some points about it that you have never heard before. And as soon as the rest of this information is available to you, and some of it I cannot bring to you tonight because I have an agreement with the source that has brought me this information that I'm going to wait until we have definite results from this observation. But this is breaking news about Comet Elenin tonight. We're going to cover this from a couple of different standpoints. And one of the things I want you to be ready for is maybe to have your paradigm about your government, the kind of information that it presents you. Well, we're not going to approach this from a conspiracy theory point of view. We rarely do that on this program. I will bring you factual material. I'll bring you as much original recorded news release, not necessarily web blog or web conspiracy stuff, but this will be stuff off the mainstream news, some of it international news that doesn't get viewed very often. I know this because when you go to the news feed itself, sometimes it has less than 100 views. So this is, yes, mainstream, but it isn't really out there very much. It doesn't get a lot of airplay. And we're going to connect some dots tonight that will have you thinking, will have you reassessing perhaps your future plans as to what you want to concentrate on or what you want to spend your time on. And as we do this, I want you to keep in mind, and this is by no means one long infomercial, but I want you to keep in mind that our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com are ready to receive your order for any emergency preparedness items that you may need. That can be a 72-hour kit. It can be a 2-year supply. It can be a water filter. It can be anything that you think your first aid kit or your survival pack requires. And, you know, I will tell you that I've got some friends that have survival packs that would make a stay at a luxury hotel excellent, and it'd make you feel like you're not camping at all. But this is really, really a lot of preparation, a lot of investment, a lot of care taken putting something together where you can survive without organized shelter, electricity, filtered water, etc. And you don't have to go that far. Of course, the further you go, the easier you make it on yourself. Being down here on the Gulf Coast, I have interviewed dozens of people who have been through Katrina. They've been through Camille. They know what it's like to go for a week or two without power, without water, without gasoline. They know how to rely on themselves. They know how to be reliable for others. And I'm telling you that you have an opportunity to think ahead. You have an opportunity to prepare. Then visit my friend Paul Faust and his firefighter buddies in New York on their website, 1-800-PREPARE.com. And as you're checking out, please put in my name, Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, and you'll get another 10% off. Now, let's get to tonight's subject matter. It is no government secret that governments have been increasing the building of massive underground facilities, seed vaults, and hoarding life-sustaining essentials recently. Many of the global elite, and if you've been watching the news lately or checking into a Drudge Report, you know that the Bilderbergs are meeting in Switzerland as we speak, and they are discussing how they will be moving their billions and trillions around the planet, how they will be manipulating things like trade, money, currency exchanges, and even warfare to manage the population of Earth. And I don't mean manage its numbers. I mean to manage the population in the sense of how much they're going to eat, how wealthy they're going to allow you to get, how much money they want you to spend. And they will be deciding on what the credit limits are. They will be deciding on where you will live and what you will eat and what you will seek out as your career. So it's already happening. They have purchased huge amounts of property in the Southern Hemisphere, especially South America, and some have already moved there. If you saw the movie X-Men First Class. Yeah. Oh, very good. Yeah. Lots of popularity out there. One of the scenes in this movie was in Argentina. Do you remember that scene? When the super power being that would be known, Eric, who would be known as Magneto later in life, meets up with a couple of Nazi hideaways in a hotel there. Well, the scene as you're coming up to the hotel is rather mountainous and beautiful, and it looks like it could be out of a Bavarian movie. That's Argentina. That's the kind of properties that are being purchased. That is the kind of beauty that is being bought up for pennies. Pennies, because we're not talking about, you know, the Virginia coast. We're not talking about Pacific Palisades in California. We're talking about the way the Pacific Palisades used to look in the 20s when it can be scooped up by movie stars or investors for a fraction of what it's worth today. That's what's happening in South America. A couple of other reasons it's happening in higher elevations is because perhaps something is going to happen in the Northern Hemisphere that might make it a little treacherous to live here, might make it a little primitive. Now, whether that's an ice age, whether it's a super storm, or whether it's a government conflict, well, that remains to be seen. But one of the things that we notice, we follow the money on this program. We put things together in a scientific manner, piece by piece, dot by dot. And one of the things that we notice is that governments, our government, the Russian government, and other governments are spending money, not a small amount of money, a large amount of money, on building shelters. Now, the story I'm about to share with you, it headlines Russia building 5,000 more, and they call them nuclear bomb shelters, British people totally exposed. Now, I'm going to play this for you. This is a mainstream news feed, okay? I want you to listen closely to the newswoman and male news anchor as they discuss this issue. They're also going to interview a reporter in Russia who has obtained the information and is reporting it back. This is very recent, so listen closely.
5,000 new emergency bomb shelters will be created in Moscow. The city has just given architects the task of coming up with the designs. So let's speak to our correspondent, Ivor Bennett, to get a few more details on this. Ivor, why do the authorities want these shelters building? That's the big question.
Why? Well, it's because there are only enough shelters at the moment in the city to house and shelter around half the city's population, which, compared to other places in the world, isn't out of the ordinary. That figure is sort of 50% coverage. For example, Switzerland is the only country where there are enough shelters for the entire country's population. But Moscow wants to build another 5,000 shelters, not necessarily because it's expecting nuclear war. We shouldn't be running for cover, anything like that. It's a precaution, because in the last 20 years, this area has been very underdeveloped. The current shelters, a lot of them are outdated and unprepared for this situation. A lot of them have been privatized, for example, and are now restaurants or bars. The Moscow metro system, that was specifically built, its station specifically built, very deep underground, so they could double as air raid shelters. For example, the station I'm standing outside right now, Mayakovskaya Station, that did just that during the Second World War. And in 1943, it famously was the site where Stalin addressed party leaders and ordinary Muscovites in a Communist Party meeting during the Second World War. But these shelters, 5,000 will be built because basically there aren't enough at the moment. And in the next 2 years, the plans will be developed for their construction.
Okay, so we've got the time frame. But Ivor, where are they going to be located and what will they look like?
Well, they'll actually be quite small, hence the high number of them, 5,000. And they'll be dotted around all over the city because the metro system at the moment, in the outskirts especially, is quite far away from where a lot of people live. And the authorities say that in the event of a nuclear outbreak, people need to reach one of these shelters within a matter of minutes. So they'll be basically where people congregate. So underneath apartment blocks, underneath shopping centres, sports complexes, parks, places like that. And they won't be very deep, not as deep as the metro system, around 10 or 15 metres deep underground. And there hasn't been any mention of cost yet, but a prototype is being developed at the moment. The architects have been tasked with that. And so that this uniform prototype will be developed, and that apparently will speed up production by 10 to 15%.
Okay, there's a couple things. There are a couple of things to pay close attention here. Number one is that these are going to be located where people are located. Why? He said so that they could get in them in a matter of minutes. We're not talking about preparation for intercontinental ballistic missiles. In that respect, you have 30 to 45 minutes to make your move. This is a matter of minutes, which means that whatever event is being planned for is something that there will be short notice. You will not be able to drive cars. You won't be able to hit the freeways. You won't be able to make a mass migration in a rapid time frame. The second thing is only half the population right now could fit into the existing shelters. That's way more than most nations have. Now, Switzerland has enough shelters for everyone under the ground. But the United States, for instance, I dare say you couldn't go to any city that's not in a tornado zone where anybody on any street in any mall could tell you where the nearest shelter is. It's just not thought of. It's not part of our social paradigm. The last thing is that these are not going to be deep shelters, 10 to 15 meters. Now, I will tell you, in the event of a nuclear event, I was in the Air Force. I was trained on an air base that was ground zero, number one, target number one, more of a target than Washington, D.C. And I can tell you, 10 to 15 meters are absolutely meaningless in a nuclear outbreak. You've got to be deeper than that. That means that these shelters are not being built for a nuclear event. Maybe they're being marketed to the people as a nuclear event, but they're not for that purpose. The last thing, I said that was the last thing, this is the last thing, the time frame. 5,000 shelters in 2 years. Not 5 years, not a 10-year plan, not a 4-year plan like we would have in a single presidency. 2 years, 24 months. And I don't think all 5,000 of them are going to be ready on the 24th month. They started yesterday. Now, the question is why? And that's the subject of tonight's program. Did you know that the United States government, on average, builds 2 to 3 deep underground facilities each year? That doesn't even include the ones already built that are constantly being added to. When do we realize that our government knows something that we do not? We are not preparing for war. Those kinds of wars aren't fought anymore. We may have a rogue event. We may have some terrorist out there who blows up one bomb or two. But that's not the global catastrophe. That's not the kind of thing that gets every nation building underground shelters. Something else. How about when it suddenly ramps up in a trend to write checks governments simply cannot cover? That's what's been happening with our country. That's why our rate has been downgraded. Now, you heard the president's spokesman just the other night saying, oh, come on, look, we've known about this for 40 years. We've been spending more than we take in for 40 years. The deficit is the deficit. Americans are just not as productive now as they have been. And as soon as we are, we'll pull right out of this and everything will be fine. Well, that may be the case. It may be the case. What I want to do is make sure that you know the phone lines are open tonight. This is a program that's going to excite a lot of response. So I want you to go to xsquaredradio.com, go to bsradio.com. You know the phone numbers. I would announce them, but I don't want to take away from what I'm doing right at the moment. Phone lines are open right now if you want to call in. I'm not trying to alarm you. I'm trying to discover something for you, because the information that I give you this first hour is going to change everything that you thought, everything you thought you knew about what might be out there. I know when a person shows a sudden increase in irresponsible buying habits, a la maxing out every single credit card, there is often one of two events coming up soon. A feeling of doom or termination, like divorce, a job loss, impending death, something like no tomorrow, so you might as well spend all money and then some, everything they'll give you. Second is that a windfall is about to happen. The lottery, inheritance, or a settlement check, or an income tax return, and we're going to try to beat that check to the bank. I doubt the latter is going to happen, which means someone in government knows something we do not. The NASA officials in this video I'm about to share the audio with you about, the NASA official in the video mentions how NASA is the only agency responsible for the people's safety on Earth and off-planet. Either NASA referring to people as in employees of NASA, or they really mean all people. The off-planet people is interesting, since Tsar Obama has stopped the manned space program. Now, we might have some people in the space station, but other than that, we don't really have any off-planet people, I don't think. Perhaps NASA is referring to the men and women involved in the International Space Station, or maybe some that are in the space shuttle. We only have one to go, somewhere around July 8th. So as I play this video for you, this is the real thing, okay? This is not sci-fi. This isn't made up. It might be the basis for sci-fi. It might be the kind of thing that's being primed to us, and I'm going to show you some patterns in the last hour that are really going to blow your mind. But I want you to listen to the evidence. Now, all this is going to be official NASA stuff, or it's going to be official news feeds. So here we go. This is NASA sending out an email to all employees to prepare. This is a family personal preparedness video that was sent out by NASA to its own employees. Now, when you look at the text of these emails, you'll see the timeline lines up with the announcement that Colin has been discovered. Piece by piece, these things come together. The timing, the preparation, the release dates. Very important to pay attention to. The timing is a total of 2 to 3 months when all this took place and all this came out and was produced. Now, for some reason, this is very, very slowly, and I'm not exactly sure why this is happening, other than we're on Skype, and anything, or sometimes nothing, can happen on Skype. All right, well, it looks like this video is eating up all my bandwidth, so I am not going to play that video. I will back out of Firefox, and we'll just carry on. Now, the following is from NASA's official website. This is not made up. It's not fabricated. It's real. A major initiative has been placed on family personal preparedness for all NASA personnel. The NASA Family Preparedness Program is designed to provide an awareness, resources, and tools to NASA family members to prepare for an emergency situation. The most important assets in the successful completion of NASA's mission are our employees and their families. We are taking the steps to prepare our workforce, but it is your personal obligation to prepare yourself and your families for emergencies. Now, I'm not going to play that video for you because it's going to eat up the bandwidth, but this first recording is not to prepare you for an event caused on this planet. It is for an event that originates off planet. Is it possible that NASA has improved its family preparedness message? Yes, it is. Is it possible that millions are being spent on new resources, funding assistance, and information services that have been assembled and launched in less than 6 months? Yes, it is. Is it possible that NASA has been added to the list of employee training programs the government has for emergency preparedness? I'm afraid not. The level of informational systems and access methods goes far beyond this small agency. Although all the agencies, departments, administrations, agents, and various offices have been tasked to inform their people to get ready for something, the NASA message was meant to proliferate. It was meant to go viral among the people and originate from NASA, not the White House. This isn't the president coming out and saying this. These are NASA officials coming out and saying this. And they said it in such a way that the video was immediately put on YouTube. And it immediately went viral. They are trying to get us ready without the sledgehammer of panic. They have seen that this information can be released innocuously and leaked into the public. And as it's leaked into the public, it doesn't have quite the devastating effect, the kind where people would go fill up their cars and their trunks with goods and head out of town or migrate in a mass faction. That hasn't happened. Only a few people have actually picked up on this pattern and are starting to get it out to people. Now, there is a deflection pointing people to the possibility that the sun will be responsible for a drastic change in our electronic life. That's a possibility. There have been a couple news stories out there. We talk about the solar wind often on this program. Every single week we track it for you so that you know what's coming up. But there are the popular spokespeople out there trying to get us ready a little at a time. You know, Fox News science correspondent Michio Kaku is telling us to get ready, right? Let me just make an attempt to load this up because I really want him to tell you in his words. Hold on. I'll try to make it where it doesn't make me garbly. Just want you to hear it. This one should be pretty low bandwidth. Just a little bit of dead air. No problem. Hang in there. Everything's under control. Okay. Here we go. This is Michio Kaku on Fox News.
Bigger and more immediate than the threat of global warming, they say. Earth's magnetic field, which acts as our protective shield in space, has a hole in it. And that could put a lot of our earthly functions at risk. Dr. Michio Kaku, professor and author of the book Physics of the Impossible, is back with us. Professor, how are you? And good morning to you.
Glad to be on the show.
Thanks. Twice in 1 week, man. It's bonus hour. Mm-hmm. What is this solar shield?
Well, every 11 years, the sun has a temper tantrum. It releases a shockwave, a tsunami of radiation that could wipe out communication, weather satellites, GPS, spy satellites, you name it, it's up there in outer space.
So you're saying that my BlackBerry won't work?
The internet, box, television, cable, satellite TV, all of it could get wiped out around 2012. That's when we have the peak of the sunspot cycle. That's when the sun's magnetic field flips. North Pole and South Pole flip, releasing a shockwave of radiation, which will then hit the Earth minutes later, potentially wiping out a good chunk of our satellite communications. We're watching it very carefully now.
Well, this happens how often, you say?
Every 11 years.
Well, why an 11-year cycle?
It takes 11 years for the magnetic field of the sun to build up enough intensity to begin the flip process, because it slowly revolves in a circle. It's like winding up the windings of a clock. If you wind up the mainspring of a clock too much, it boing, comes out of control. Same thing with the sun's magnetic field. It literally flips every 11 years, releasing a shockwave of radiation. And that means we have to start to think about reinforcing our satellites, building redundant systems, because it means that GPS, the power grid, weather satellites, communication satellites, satellite television, all of that could get disrupted, peaking around 2012.
So your point is we can't do anything about it in space, but we can do something back here on Earth.
That's right.
But backup systems, are companies really doing that?
Well, they're going to have to do it because, see, we scientists made a mistake. We thought that the next cycle was going to be quiet. Well, some of our data was off by a factor of 20, and that's why we're issuing this alert now. We made a mistake. The next cycle, peaking around 2012, will be much more serious than we previously thought. Now, in the past, we dodged the bullet because we didn't have that many satellites up there 11, 22 years ago. Back in 1990, we didn't have that many space satellites.
Well, that makes sense to me. But, yeah, I'm listening to you talk. I'm thinking, why 2K?
I'm thinking it's all just, it's just a tactic that put a lot of fear in a lot of people. It may have gotten us ready, but there was really no danger in the end.
Well, let's hope that it's a dud. Let's hope that nothing happens. However, what if? What if our communication systems are wiped out? Billions of economic activity could be
jeopardized. Do you think anyone's taking this seriously?
I think we're going to have to. The physicists are now sounding the alert. We made a mistake. We made the wrong projection. The next growth cycle will be more intense than previously thought. And an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Now's the time to begin to create redundant systems, reinforce our satellites, build backup systems.
Right. Michio Kaku, the word is out. You know, if you render my BlackBerry useless, that's okay. I mean, you're allowed. Do that for a while, and we'll bring it back. Thank you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to know.
All right, so that is, you know, the mainstream tickler out there. The solar cycle 24, which we're in the middle of right now, well, we're actually start ramping it up right now, is going to be much worse than we originally thought. You know, we came through this long solar pause where we had really no sunspots to speak of. They were all equatorial in nature, all kind of benign. The magnetic fields were minding their own business, no major prominences. And so, you know, I think the Fox guy was trying to make a comparison with Y2K. And Y2K was perhaps fabricated by a bunch of out-of-work accountants. Not, you didn't really have the physics community out there talking about how bad the computer chips were going to crash from video cameras and computers and everything like that. The computers that we had in the year 2000 are nothing compared to the computers we have today. And in the year 2013, 2016, we're going to get computers faster than the human brain. Our computer technology will climb at an even faster rate. Now, keep in mind that this, if the solar storm is geomagnetic in nature, it's going to be a little bit like an EMP. As it could have a little bit of effect on how commerce moves, about how money moves. It might upset our electronic communication. You know what? As a society, we'd go back to the old written receipt and paper cash until we got the system back up and running. It wouldn't be the end of the world. It most certainly would not be cause to build underground shelters. That's not the kind of solar conflagration, unless, you know, you're talking about, you know, what's happened, what we predict in our first three books of the Ark of Millions of Years. But something is coming. And there's only one source that says it's coming. We're not even sure that it's real. That is Comet Elenin. Now, the interesting thing, I have a lot of missing data about this. So I'm going to just present the parts that are missing. And if you've got some information out there you want to call in, you want to present, I think I would welcome it at this point. Anybody would. But here are the pieces that are missing, my fellow Earth explorers. We have a comet out there, ostensibly, apparently, that is approaching our solar system, not from the normal cometary maelstrom that's out in the solar system, outside of our solar system, out in the galaxy somewhere, is a storm of comets that every so often ejects one that starts into a large elliptical orbit near our sun and back out into the cosmos. But that approach has always been perpendicular or near perpendicular to our solar system. It's come in, it goes around the sun, and it goes back out into space. Or it comes in, and like Schumacher did, it gets scooped up by Jupiter, falls to pieces, and is vacuumed up, just the way any large planet in any successful solar system would do. This comet isn't approaching that way. It didn't come from the same neighborhood. This comet is coming along the plane of planets. That means it's not from the same neighborhood. if it is a comet, it comes from a source, a different source of comets, one the planet has never seen before. There are a couple other things that don't make sense. I'm trying to think about what order I want to present this to you. I'll give you this one. Most comets are made up of a loose neighborhood of ice balls in space, like big ice asteroids, sort of congregating through space because there's nothing more attractive for them to attract themselves to. They go through space with a very minimal amount of gravity, sometimes less than a kilometer across. But in the blackness of space, traveling along at 40, 50, 60,000 miles an hour, there really isn't anything else to do except congregate in space, unless they get into the neighborhood of another gravitational field, a very large one like Jupiter. That's when the Roche limit, or Roche, depends on how you want to pronounce it, R-O-C-H-E, limit takes over. This is where the gravitational field of a bigger body takes over the gravitational field of the smaller body, and the forces that hold the smaller body together just sort of get overcome. And so the glue comes apart. The head falls to pieces. What was one cometary head becomes a dozen or two dozen fairly good-sized chunks, and the rest of it just becomes a bunch of boiling gas out in the middle of space. We pass through the Perseids, the Leonids, and the tail of Halley's Comet on an annual basis. There's no head left. The head long since broke up and evaporated. But the tail keeps coming around on its regular orbit, and Earth passes through it, and so we see a lot of little grain of sand-sized meteorites that make pretty streaks in the sky, maybe some of them the size of an ice cube, which bounce off the atmosphere and make a pretty show. But no real big visible head to view. This one isn't doing that. This one is approaching our solar system along several orbiting planets' pathways. It is coming closer than most comets will come. At its closest approach, it will be some 20 million miles away from Earth. That's about half the distance between the Earth and Mars. It isn't coming apart. The head is much more structured, which means it's probably not an asteroid, or probably not a comet. It could be an asteroid. If it is, it's a very large one. It could be a small planet. It's possible. I'm going to explain the odds of that in the second hour. But some have even said that it has a really strange structure. However, that brings me to one of the missing pieces of data. It's out there. We have a photograph. One photograph, and every single thing that we have seen in space since has been of that one photograph. And so I have to wonder, why aren't there more photographs of this thing? Why aren't there more people with telescopes out there looking at it? Well, the reason is that right now we need a very powerful telescope in order to see this thing. Your average 8-inch scope isn't going to see it. Your contracted scopes are all taken up. So that is to say they're all contracted, okay? So we don't really have any other information other than this one piece of data. And that's pretty strange to me, because it would seem to me that if there was this comet out there and it was presenting this kind of, let's call it a threat, let's call it an event, that it would seem there'd be more than one photograph of it. They'd be watching it. They'd be watching every move it made. And so, you know, going back to the mainstream media, we're asking the question again, what is this thing? We have one photograph of it. Oh, it's been blown up. You know, when you look at the photograph of this thing, and you can go on Fox News archives and you can look at this, there's one picture of it. It looks so CG. It looks so contrived. It looks like it doesn't even look as good a quality as what you would see on the movie Deep Impact. But they still don't know what it is. It's a mystery. So I'm going to play Michio Kaku one more time, Fox News. I want you to listen closely as they ask him, what is this thing? Are you ready for this?
Sometimes the BC boys are out in space, right? What is that on screen? No astronomer has seen this before. Scientists say they're clueless about what it might be. A meteor, a star, clearly a UFO, as in unidentified. Michio Kaku is a theoretical physics professor and host of the new Science Channel series, Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible. Tuesdays at 10 o'clock, we're in for a second season. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Back on the screen, what is it? We don't know. We are stumped. Scientists around the world are saying, what the heck is this object? It doesn't fit any of the profiles of the usual suspects. That's the problem.
Usual suspects are comet, meteor,
stars, galaxies, planets.
How about some sort of alien dealio?
Could be.
That?
Well, you know, the object is about the size of the Rose Bowl Stadium. So it's too small to be a planet or a star or a galaxy. And it's not a comet. There's no gas in the tail of that comet. It's not a meteor because it's not inside the Earth's atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
So what is it? We're scratching our head. The only thing we can think of at the present time is a once-in-a-lifetime event, the collision of two asteroids in space. We've never seen that before, creating a starburst of debris. And if that theory is correct, it means with the weeks, the starfish should get bigger and bigger and eventually fade away.
So the asteroid collision, it may have happened before. We just have not seen evidence of it.
This is the
Okay, I'm going to stop just for a moment because it's a very important speculation that he made here. Now, this was in the early part of October of last year. It is now June of 2011. So we're 8 months later. What he said was, in the coming weeks, if this was the collision of two asteroids, it will break up and fade away. That is what he said. There has not been a photograph of this thing since. If it was on the trajectory that they're suspecting that it's on, and JPL still has the data up, they're still tracking it on their website, and very shortly, maybe on this program, will be the first place that you will see the new photograph of Comet Elenin. If it's there, it means that this speculation that it's two colliding asteroids has been disproven. If it's not there, two things. Either it could be supportive of this theory, or it isn't where JPL says it is. Let me continue with this. It's a couple more minutes. Hang in there.
First time it's been caught on camera, if it is an asteroid collision.
And what would that mean to folks like you? You would study that to figure out what, Michio?
Well, we realize that asteroids are predictable. We know exactly where they are going around the sun. But if they collide, it's a game changer. We think that may have wiped out the dinosaurs. There was a cosmic collision about 100 million years ago. Debris was sent all over the asteroid belt. And one piece, get this, one piece hit the Earth from that collision about 65 million years ago, and that's when the dinosaurs died, in perhaps just 1 year. So we think that an asteroid collision, a big one, probably wiped out the dinosaurs.
Wow, so that would be significant for people like you, because what happened was, I guess some folks saw this deep in space and they said, you need to check that out. So we took the Hubble telescope and we pointed it in this direction, and now we have these brilliant pictures.
That's right. A month ago, we spot this little speck doing all sorts of shenanigans that it shouldn't be doing. The Hubble Space Telescope zooms in on it, and we, our jaws hit the floor. At that point, we're saying,
now, it's called the P/2010 A2. And you say that's short for...
We are clueless.
Nicely done. So we have to learn a lot more about these asteroid collisions.
That tells
a lot about our future, right?
That's right. And they're random. We don't know where they come from. And if the debris hits the Earth, they're unpredictable. And we think the dinosaurs got wiped out precisely in this way.
Only if they had the Hubble. Come on. Tuesday night, 10 o'clock. Check him out on the Science Channel. Michio, thank you very much.
Right.
Good to
thank
see you.
You
as always.
Okay, that's the Michio Kaku interview. It's the only one out there really talking about this comet, now called Elenin. And why is it called Elenin? Because of Leonid Elenin. Some people say that he's not real. It's a coded message. There has been some research done out there to find the history and background of the alleged astronomer Leonid Elenin. But... there's just barely anything written about it, okay? Now, as luck would have it, this is just going to blow your mind. The synchronicity is just unbelievable here. Deep Impact, the movie, okay? It's about an ELE, extinction level event, an asteroid hitting Earth or a comet hitting Earth. In the movie... Of course, the president was Morgan Freeman. In the movie, the kid who discovered the comet was named Leo. A Russian name, Leonid, is Russian for Leo. Leo, Leonid, kind of interesting. Both discoveries in reality and in Deep Impact were born in January. Both comets in reality and the movie are discovered on a 10th. Day of the month, May 10th, 1999, and December 10th, 2010. That's 11 years apart. It's 2011. The movie starred Elijah, E-L-I, Wood, and the word Nin, or nine, tattooed on his body. And T, Leonid, the 8299 Tia Leone asteroid is named after her. Deep Impact was her ninth film. You know, it's just interesting. Everything is scripted well in advance, and they use Hollywood to drop the clues. Now, it doesn't look like a comet. It doesn't look like a brown dwarf, way too small. The data points lead us to believe that we need another scope to look at it. Well, there is another scope. It's a 9-meter scope, and it's getting ready to look at it. And as soon as the weather clears, we're going to get a shot of it, where it's supposed to be. NASA spear chuckers are coming on strong, trying to discredit anyone who tries to release the truth, it appears. It is diligent and monitoring all transmissions. So we are very, very careful about letting this out, except here on X Squared Radio, you are going to learn about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth right here. Nothing held back. Hang on one moment while I plug something in. Don't go away. A little bit of dead air. Just 10 seconds. Don't go away. Had to do that because I had the low battery alarm. Rarely happens on this program, but we have it. So let's talk about what we're going to talk about in the second hour, this idea of rogue planets. If we're not talking about asteroids colliding together, if this comet slash asteroid fragment is still there in the next couple of days as we pray for clear skies with this 27-foot diameter mirror, and we get this information one way or the other, we're going to find out. So if this does come into our neighborhood, it's going to seriously affect communications. It's going to seriously affect the way that we do commerce. You know, right now we walk around with plastic in our pockets because the process of alchemy is almost complete. We've made the shift from gold to paper to plastic, to imaginary ones and zeros as a way of transferring our value from one person to another. We go to work every day and they generate ones and zeros in the form of a decimal of some multiplication, and they deposit it into what? A numbered account, which really isn't your name anymore. It's now this 10-digit number on a 9-digit routing code. And that is your wealth in the world. And whether you travel to China or whether you're going to Rhode Island or Los Angeles or Las Vegas, you can scan your little magnetic strip and you can extract your money from that numbered account. You can convert it into chips or cash or a Big Mac. And that is how we move value around our planet. But it's all electronic. All those ones and zeros, little abacus beads stacked on top of one another in some room somewhere in another dimension, are just numbers, just massless, meaningless numbers. That's your value. Unless you know how to grow a squash in your garden, then you have something tangible you can hold on to. Then you have some work or some thing that you have produced. You can cut down a tree and you can make a chair out of it or a house out of it. You can take dirt and mortar and you can make a driveway or stack bricks one on top of the other. You can make something physical that will last, that you can trade for something you can eat or something you can wear. That's real value. That's really how it was designed. But now we have this system, which is all electronic. We can move our ideas and our value and our capabilities back and forth electronically. All that's at risk. No, we're not talking about the extinction of the human race. I don't think. But we might be talking about this extinction, at least temporarily so, of the electronic system of money. So it might be a good idea to have some or something of value in a mason jar somewhere. Just a thought, just an idea. But what if Elenin isn't there? In fact, what if I told you that Elenin, the scientist, wasn't real either? What if I told you that the entire thread of Elenin was fake? Why would you suppose that a blow-up of a blow-up of a blow-up would be leaked through various fringe sites from a telescope that doesn't even have the resolution to look at something that small? Hubble's designed to look at large sections of space. It's not designed to look at something the size of a football stadium. It doesn't have the resolution to resolve that. But what I mean by that is you can't go to the beach and pick up a grain of sand and notice it significantly with a tape measure. The tape measure just can't get those little lines close enough to be able to see, so to speak, the grain of sand. Not enough resolution. Now, if you want to measure a 2x4, or you want to measure the diameter of a bolt or a wheel, yeah, you could use a tape measure. You could get pretty close with it. But you can't measure something small. It's like holding up your thumb to cover a section of space and say, oh yeah, I can see that. No, you can't. You don't have the resolution. Hubble isn't made for that. The picture, the only picture that we have of this comet, this asteroid chunk, this protoplanet, came from a scope that isn't even capable of photographing it effectively. So, why would Michio Kaku make a commitment, a comment, that we really don't know what this is? He was pretty honest. We're clueless. We don't know what this is. That's what he's saying. So for the last few months, that's all we really know, because nobody, regardless of the fact that this thing is traveling through space at some 1,900 miles an hour, or maybe faster than that, it's got to be faster than that. My calculations are 1,900 miles an hour. That's probably way, way low. It's probably more like 19,000 miles an hour. And it's going to be sometime in September, it's going to be at its closest point, which is roughly half the distance between the moon and Mars, about 20 million miles. If it's off-gassing, we'll be able to see it with the naked eye. If it's not off-gassing, forget about it. You're going to need a pretty good scope, and I would think maybe even a reflecting scope wouldn't be able to see it unless it's off-gassing pretty well. You would be able to see it with a refracting scope. The difference? A refracting scope is a series of lenses, like you would look through a regular telescope, through a small eyepiece and then a more and more and more powerful lens. Of course, the problem with scopes like this is they don't gather a whole lot of light. They do magnify quite well. But as far as looking at planets, you really have to have a good motor drive. You got to know exactly where that thing is, and then you can get the scope on there and get some really decent pictures. If you don't know exactly where it is, it's not in your motor drive database. Even if you did get it in the eyepiece, the rotation of Earth would send it out of the eyepiece before you could say to your friend, hey, come here, look at this. By the time he put his eye on it, it would be gone. That's how fast the Earth is rotating relative to anything in space that's that small. A refracting scope reflects the light off of a mirror that's much larger. Can be 4 inches for a small one, can be 12 to 14 inches for a very expensive one for the average consumer. And it focuses all of that light onto a smaller mirror, which then goes into the ocular. And that's how you can actually see objects in space. Pretty good for looking at nebula, not very good for looking at planets, because the ocular blocks out part of the mirror, and you just don't get the resolution. You can, and it does. They make great Schmidt-Cassegrain scopes because they get a very long focal length out of something that's very short, and it's effective to use. The problem is that, of course, you have to spend a lot of money, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 to get a scope like that to be able to look at things. Hold on one moment. Okay, I've got something I can get my hands around here. And what we will do is take a quick break now, because it is the first hour is gone, but I have laid a good foundation, because what I want to present to you in the second hour is about free-floating planets. We've talked about them in our book. It's at the time we wrote the book, The Arc of Millions of Years, free-floating planets were, you know, out there, and they were numbered in a decent number. There were some predictions, something like 10 to the third, 10 to the fourth free-floating planets out there. Well, the numbers are much higher, and the planets are much bigger than what you thought. And now the story gets pretty interesting. So we'll take a quick break, 3 minutes or so, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you from southern Mississippi, just north of the Gulf of Mexico. Our IQ window forecast, about 90 degrees outside, and just about as much moisture as you can fit in the air without it falling down around your ears. If you have read the book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, you might want to pick up the audio version as well. It's available at rememberingthefuturebook.com. If you purchased the book from our website, you already got the audio version for free because it's a bonus. And if you haven't read the book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, then this commercial is for you because you can, of course, pick it up at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, blah, 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 everywhere else. But if you buy it at the website, rememberingthefuturebook.com, you will get the book autographed. You will get the audio version as a download the instant you place your order while you're waiting for it to arrive. And you'll also, by going to the website, have the color version of all those illustrations in the book for free, right on the website. All you have to do is access it. And, of course, the book is available on Kindle and Nook, and you can read it on your iPad. And we try to accommodate all forms of reading. We want to make sure that you read. But if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you, and you get it for free. Wanted to let you know that if you have read the book, there is a form of meditation that's talked about in the book called Flower of Life Meditation. I am not an official instructor for that meditation, but I am an enthusiast of the meditation. I use it. I'm a busy person. You know that if you listen to this program. And I need a meditation that gets me in quickly. I don't have time to sit around all night. I can't sit around for a couple of hours a day and meditate. The Flower of Life Meditation gets you in 17 breaths. I introduce to you in the book the 18th breath. Why? Yes, you could become a master. You could take classes. You could learn about all it, but we don't have enough time. Read the book. Learn about the meditation in the back of the book. It's a tool, a useful tool to learn how to listen to the universe, because as you apply your energy to the universe, it will resonate just like ringing a bell. You need to be able to hear the bell ringing, especially amongst the noise and turmoil of a busy 21st century life. That's what the meditation is good for. Now, if you want to become skilled at it, and I highly recommend that you do, I would go to the same teachers that I went to. Of course, I originally learned a meditation from friends, then took a class from Drunvalo Melchizedek at his website, floweroflife.com or flowerofliferadio.org. And then I took advanced classes from my master teacher, who is Maureen St. Germain. Her link is on the website at rememberingthefuturebook.com. It's also on the website at xsquaredradio.com. She is the one that is, in my opinion, the best Flower of Life meditation teacher on the planet. The CD, the audio CD that she produces, called the Merkaba 2 meditation, goes with the book. It teaches you, not only teaches you the meditation, but it steps you through the meditation in an audio fashion. You can listen to it a few dozen times and you can master the meditation. Then I highly recommend taking one of her affordable classes by going to MaureenStGermain.com. Sign up for one of those. There's always one pretty close to your neighborhood several times a year, and they're very affordable, and actually you can't afford to miss it. So I highly recommend that. Now, back to what we were talking about free-floating planets, rogue planets. And I wanted to mention that most of the time we have a way of introducing ideas to the masses in such a way that it doesn't panic them. We discovered early in the 50s that if we talked about nuclear war, for instance, or we talked about aliens landing on the planet with a radio program, that people would panic. They'd go out and shoot water towers, and they would jump out of buildings, and they would be traumatized. And so ever since then, we kind of had a pattern, a method, a process by which radical new information is introduced to people. First, we start with science fiction movies. It's just a movie. It's not really real. But after a few dozen movies of aliens invading and different robots and, you know, brain-eating, flesh-eating zombies, and you know, after a while people just get habituated to it, and then when the news really comes on, oh, by the way, that thing we were telling you about aliens coming and eating your brains, it's all real. Well, then you don't panic. Okay, maybe you panic just a little bit. But it's not like it would be all new to you. You're walking down the street eating cookies and drinking milk, and all of a sudden, we interrupt this program to bring you an important announcement. Aliens are coming, and they're going to eat your brain. No, that's not going to happen. So they incrementally warm you up to it. And you'll remember in 1999, it's sort of like, gosh, one screenwriter had a great idea, and he had breakfast in one place and got drunk in another place. And in both places, somebody was searching for a movie idea and said, wow, that's really a great idea for a movie. And sure enough, in 1999, we had two movies introduced in the same season, one on top of the other. We had Deep Impact and we had Armageddon. Now, Deep Impact had Elijah Wood, it had Morgan Freeman, it had its share of stars. It was good. It was well directed. It was well photographed. It had great music, a very poignant message. And then you had Armageddon. You had Bruce Willis, and you had Liv Tyler, and you had, you know, come on, you had it all there. It's questionable as to which movie was better, though. I don't know. Maybe you could call in and give me your idea which one was better. There was a different tone altogether with both movies, of course. One was a bunch of oil rig roughnecks that, you know, managed to go up and drill a hole on an asteroid or a comet and blow it apart. And the other one is an aging shuttle pilot who knows how to actually fly in space. And all of the young pups have been flying automated craft their whole life in the Air Force and don't really know how to negotiate a craft in and around a comet. In both, some of them commit suicide trying to save the Earth from this deep impact comet. Two different directors, two different ideas, same screenplay idea. Go figure. Go figure. Yeah, the secret is don't have breakfast in Hollywood anywhere and talk about your movie, okay? Yeah, we might talk about my screenplay a little bit on here, but I learned my lesson, not very well. I still blab about it, but anyway, I want to just jump on the website really quick here. Watch out for interrupting bandwidth. Hang on. Don't go away. It might get a little wobbly because I'm in Mississippi. Enough said right there, right? Comcast is the carrier here. So if Comcast works where you are, I hate you. No, seriously, Comcast is not doing a very good job in Mississippi. Our phone numbers, if you are calling off-planet, the number is 530-413-4511. If you're calling from west of Earth, it's 530-413-4515. And if you're calling east of Earth, it is 530-413-4520. Which movie did you like better, Deep Impact or Armageddon? I guess it depends on if you're a Morgan Freeman fan or a Bruce Willis fan. I liked them both. I think they had interesting comments on both of them. Yeah, my studio is telling me, nah, we have a T1 here in California. I got it. Okay, I'm going to run an extension cord from Tennessee, where they have T1 lines, down here to Mississippi so we can have good communication. Comcast is really a third world country when it comes to cable. So we'll try to hang on the entire 3 hours. If we get knocked out, well, that's the way it goes. We'll try to jump back on. Free-floating planets. What in the world are they getting us ready for? Now, I have to say, you know, we're talking about planets popping in our neighborhood. How could that be? Don't planets like revolve around suns? Like we have 8 or 9 planets, that depends on which astronomical school you go to, revolving around our sun. And when we look out into space, well, you don't really see planets, and we still can't see planets from here. That's why we have the Kepler mission out there looking for planets. What we see are stars. We see points of light out there, and we look at these points of light, and we watch them very closely with very precise measurements, and we notice that the stars wobble from time to time. They get tugged one way and the other, and then we realize, oh, yeah, that's because they have planets revolving around them. So we can tell by the frequency of the wobble and the amplitude of the wobble how big the planet is, because we know that the orbit has to be a certain size for a certain mass, and we see the amplitude of the wobble of the sun, and we realize pretty much how big that planet is. And that's how we found planets for a long, long time, until we launched Kepler. Then we went from knowing there were 100 or so planets out there to a couple thousand. And it's increasing every single day. And the odds of being able to find a planet that's very Earth-like, that is to say, close enough to the sun and far away from enough from the sun with water on it that it can actually sustain life as we know it. But if you read The Arc of Millions of Years in chapter 2 of the first book, we talk about the information that was available in the year 2004. Boy, that was a long time ago, wasn't it? The information that was available in 2004 about how many free-floating planets, exoplanets, planets that don't have anything to do with the star. They're just meandering, sashaying through space by themselves without maybe a moon going around them, but not anything that we can see in the blackness of space. No star going with them. And the number was significant. It was in the hundreds of thousands. Well, that turns out not to be entirely accurate. Now, astronomers, including a NASA-funded team member, have discovered a new class of Jupiter-sized planets floating alone in the dark of space, away from the light of a star. These are not small planets. These aren't planets like Mars or Earth or Venus or Mercury floating through space, blown loose by some powerful magnetic wind or a supernova, or because a star ended up exploding or something and launching all the planets out into space. We're talking about Jupiter-sized planets. Planets large enough to vacuum up other planets. Like going through space like a giant super magnet. The team believes these lone worlds probably were ejected from developing planetary systems. Could be. Sometimes they're pulled apart as galaxies collide. You know, this Sagittarius galaxy and Milky Way galaxy collided. And many, including me, believe that Earth came from the Sagittarius galaxy. We don't belong in this solar system. We're adopted. The discovery is based on a joint Japan-New Zealand survey that scanned the center of the Milky Way galaxy during 2006 and 2007. Now, if you want to know where the center of the Milky Way galaxy is, just go outside on a clear night when there's not much light pollution, and you'll see the center of the Milky Way galaxy because it's a dark rift. It's like somebody took a big eraser and just erased all the stars in a line down the center. That's an area where the gravity's so intense in the Milky Way that light has a hard time escaping. It's not an area that is devoid of bodies, I can tell you that. There's a lot in there. This is where they were looking. This evidence revealed that up to 10 free-floating planets, roughly the mass of Jupiter, in a very tiny little sliver of this zone. The isolated orbs, also known as orphan planets, are difficult to spot. And this team noticed that these had gone undetected until now. The planets are located at an average approximate distance of 10,000 to 20,000 light years from Earth. Well, that's a long way. We don't have to worry about that in our lifetime or 10,000 lifetimes from now, because planets don't travel at the speed of light. Planets travel at much slower speeds. I'm going to read a quote here. He says, although free-floating planets have been predicted, they finally have been detected, holding major implications for planetary formation and evolution models, says Mario Perez, exoplanet program scientist at NASA headquarters in Washington. The discovery indicates there are many more free-floating planet Jupiter size that can't be seen. They're out there, maybe closer than 10,000 light years. The team estimates there are about twice as many of them as stars. Let me read that one more time, just so you know. You're looking out at the night sky in Idaho or Florida down by the Keys or North Carolina, where they have some of the best dark skies on the eastern seaboard, and you see a lot of stars. Count them up one night. Well, you probably can't. You could take a picture with your telescope and have your computer count up the stars. It's a lot. The team estimates there are about twice as many of these orphan planets, Jupiter-size free-floating mass planets, as stars. In addition, these worlds are thought to be at least as common as planets that orbit stars. This adds up to hundreds of billions of lone planets in our Milky Way galaxy alone. Now we're talking about something that is statistically significant. Now we're talking about something that we might not have any warning about. Now we're having something that Hubble couldn't find, no telescope could see unless it's very, very good at gathering light, and unless it just happens to go by, something that it's emitting light that it would reflect off of, and that light might happen to reflect in our direction and might happen to be picked up by our telescopes. It could float right by and we wouldn't even see it. Jupiter-sized planets. Let's see what the night skies are like out in Idaho. Joe, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Brooks. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful.
It's evening, I guess, where you're at here.
Yep. Isn't it? It's evening.
I'm doing good, and actually we've had some fairly decent skies. We've been able to see the stars a little bit, although it's been some overcast. But other than that, there's a white haze that seems to be a constant part of our sky anymore, and there still are some jets seemingly traveling around that cause it to be that way. I mean, I've taken videos and even reported it to the Attorney General's office of jets, and you can see this stuff oozing out and all over the place. And by the end of the day, when it was a clear morning, if there was a clear morning, that by the end of the day, the skies are white. So I kind of wanted to comment a little bit and get your intake on the idea of this, maybe the reasons for shelters are for other things also. It seems like there are a great many things that are either being told to us to make us worry or real things that we might want to worry about things that come in the sky that make little holes in our rhubarb plants, make our strawberry blossoms turn black. The University of Montana in Missoula seem to have scientists over there at the Department of Forestry that show very high levels of barium and aluminum and cesium in the soils, and the good bugs in the water are dying, and that it's turning our acidic-based forest soils more alkaline. So I kind of wonder your thought on that, and as far as the shelters go. And then also, I don't know whether I'm alone in this, but I'm what you people might call a believer. I don't know whether I want to call myself a Christian. I guess that's a good enough word for it. I just am a believer, and it seems that we see things there that tell us what are supposed to come in this, and the Word has told us. And I kind of hear a lot of these people at churches talking about we're supposed to be looking for this and this and this and this and this. Well, when I look at things such as chapter 6 in Revelations, the apocalyptic horses, it seems to me that it's kind of easy to see where we're at a lot. The first horse was a white horse, conquering into conquering. Well, man and death, that kind of conquered the earth. And the next one was a red horse, and that was to make war and kill one another. The great sword, we've had that for centuries. The third horse was the black horse, and on him had a pair of balances, and in his hand, and a measure of wheat for a penny, and three measures of barley for a penny, and it says, "And see that thou hurt not the oil and the wine." Well, that sounds like packaging. And on top of courthouses and stuff, we see this statue of a blindfolded woman holding up these balances, and we're trading.
Why it's up there, because it's in that book. You know, we've had that book for a long, long time. I mean, for 400 and almost 500 years now, we've had that book. So we already know what that future is predicted. So we're empowered. We could choose another future if we want. It's not like we're marching inexorably down the road to Armageddon. We could choose another future if we want to. You know, prophecies, which it wouldn't make us an unbeliever to say this, prophecies are just conditional predictions. This is what's going to happen if you don't do this. This is what's going to happen if you continue doing this. So what tonight's program is about is that what we're seeing now are the signs of not just our government, but many governments, that officials are getting ready for some kind of cosmic event. Now, it could be contrails, I don't, chemtrails. I don't really know. But I doubt it. I don't think a shelter 15 meters deep enough to hold everybody in the city for chemtrails. We just simply stop flying them.
Well, we have this thing also in Japan, and I kind of and when you go on, the next one was death, and hell followeth after him. And you know, we're seeing already the famines and the sword, and our food has been poisoned, and the drug pushers, the pharmaceutical companies, are killing a lot of people and giving them sick. It seems like we're in the middle of that now. The fifth horse was wondering how come
before.
You know, there wasn't vengeance,
before.
But
you know, we fought wars for that. We fought the opium wars over the same thing. Europe was almost completely addicted to opium, and finally the government said, that's it. We're going to sink the ships. We're going to war with China because our entire country is addicted. We've already fought wars over that. This could be a statement of history.
The sixth horse says that there will be a great earthquake, and the sun will become black, and that the stars of heaven fell to the earth. So, you know, these things say that this is what's supposed to happen.
But it's already happened. All that stuff has already happened, Joe.
Matthew 24, they all kind of say the same thing, great earthquake and stars falling and signs in the heavens. And so,
but Joe, that stuff has already happened.
Yeah.
That's historical stuff. It's already happened on our planet. It's not like we've gone along without Mount Vesuvius, that we've gone along without Krakatoa, we've gone along without the great earthquake of New Madrid. We've had those events. They've already occurred. There's no specialness.
The stars falling from heaven.
Of course, there's craters all over the planet that indicate that.
So what you're saying then, and that's the question I have for you, and I wonder if I'm a little alone as being a believer on your show what you figure that this has already happened and it has nothing to do with these predictions and this old tornado.
I didn't say it has nothing to do with it. It's all about empowering the reader. You know, you don't want to go through life ignorant. It's one thing to believe and then to have faith, but then sooner or later you have to replace faith with pure knowledge.
Yes.
And once you have knowledge, then you don't have to believe. You don't have to have faith anymore. You know, and then you can move on.
One other question there, and then I'll get off, and that I wonder about what they may be preparing for, and you've touched on it some about what's going on at Antarctica and different things that are going on with Earth, but it seems like that there was something floating around about Richard Byrd's travel to Antarctica and Operation High Jump and meeting other individuals there, and there are two books out now, one called Transylvania Sunrise and the other Transylvania Moonrise, about digging into a chamber that had a force field around it under a sphinx in the mountains, Buceki Mountains in Romania on the Transylvanian Plateau, where they got into this chamber and they found tunnels that went into Egypt. And it set off an alarm in a similar chamber that they found in Iraq. And it seems that there were like a 6-foot-tall table for like giants to use it. And when they would put their hand over this instrument, that they would read their DNA. And some of these things, they found star charts, other things, whether this is an energy chamber. But it seems like there has been a frantic dig under the Sphinx in Egypt also.
Yeah, I have photographs of that one.
Along with
not really
reports
sure.
of hearing things about the U.S. having possibly a war with beings in this Operation High Jump, where evidently there was quite a battle and maybe a ship sunk down there just off Antarctica, that there is a possibility that there are beings in the Earth, and I guess you're planning on going there next year.
Tell me a little bit more about this book, The Transylvanian Moonrise and Transylvanian Sunrise. Do you have a copy of these books?
No, but I've listened quite a bit, and I'm going to order them. I can't find the last one. I've had other things to take care of here, but they're really, I've done some study on them as far as I can on the internet, but it's by Radu Sinemar and Peter Moon. Peter Moon was the one who wrote about the Montauk Project. I'm quite interested in these ley lines and pyramids as the energy source, the whole Earth as a generator, actually. But what they did was that they found a chamber underneath the Sphinx in the Buzeci Mountains in Romania, and they got into this chamber after having to shut down a force field. This Cesar Brad, who is was a person of Department Zero, which is like the upper levels of secret intelligence of the Romanian government, was called in, and also the Italian Masonic Lodge, a Mr. Mussini, came there and talked with this Cesar Brad and told him they wanted access and all of the technology that was coming out of this place. It seems like there is other things I've researched that when they have found these kinds of tunnels where there possibly are large people living, that they find star charts, charts of flying machines, of surgeries, of all kinds of technology that are way beyond our, most of us's comprehension. Let me put it that way. Who knows who's, I don't think there's an open, free knowledge these days. I think universities are used to hide knowledge myself.
Well, it definitely sounds like a mystery of the universe, and we're going to investigate. So I will follow up on your lead, and we'll see what we can dig up, and maybe we'll have you back on the program to talk about it. Let's see what it reveals.
Okay, and what do you think about other beings being something that some governments might worry about? And I'll get off and let you go on here, and I appreciate your time. Have a nice evening.
Thanks so much, Joe. I think that, governments treat their airspace as sovereign. They don't like anything flying around in it that they don't authorize. We don't even like a Cessna flying across the lawn unless we know what's up there. That's why everything has a transponder on it. And I would say governments get particularly nervous if something's up there that can make an F-18 look like a biplane. So maybe they would, try to capture it and say, we want to know what makes this thing tick, and we want to know if you're hostile. And I think if you're not going to respond to our radio transmissions and land where we tell you to land, we're going to consider you hostile, and that's the way it goes. And I think with the Homeland Security and the Patriot Act, we've gotten kind of crazy anyway. We've completely changed our lifestyle in our country based on the act of a very, very few people on this planet. And I, for one, think it's about time we stop groping each other at airports. And I want my Minute Mart back. I want all the one-inch bulletproof glass taken down, and I want the bad guys to go away. I want my country back. I want my family to be able to greet me when I get off the airplane. That's the nation I used to know. That's the freedom and liberty we used to have in this country. And I just don't think we should live in fear every day. We're smart enough. We know how to prevent that. We know what they look like. We know what they sound like. You let somebody pull something out of his pocket that's nefarious in an airport, and you watch what happens now. Americans will pile on that guy and stuff his mouth full of French fries. He'll never be the same. I promise you, we need to end this fear and intimidation and expense that we're laying on American travelers in our own country. Let's go back to the way we were. Joe, thanks for coming on the program. You're always welcome anytime.
Okay, thank you.
Let's carry on our exoplanetary discussion. We have about 15 minutes in this hour. Our phone numbers, if you want to be part of the program, again, 530-413-4511 if you're off-planet. And really would like to get a phone call on that line. So if you're from off-planet, you're a first-timer here, you're self-aware and you know it, I want you to give me a call on that line, 530-413-4511. We're talking about your neighborhood out there. If you're calling west of Earth, 530-413-4515. And if you're calling from east of Earth, it's 530-413-4520. By the way, thank you for your patience on the website. We've been slow getting archives up. As you know, if you visited the website at xsquaredradio.com, we've made huge changes to the website. I like it. It's very good, thanks to my good friend Dylan Case, who has volunteered a bunch of his time and helped me learn a lot more about doing websites. And we're getting the archives up now the same night that that they're recorded. We did go a whole month, probably almost two, all of April and most of May, without putting any archives up, and I apologize, but I was busy doing stuff. So we just didn't have any archives that month. Didn't mean we didn't have programs. We just didn't record anything on our station at X Squared Radio. If you want to catch the archives, and there are about a half a dozen of them during that period of time, you can go to bbsradio.com, sign up for their archives, and the entire program is recorded there. We just didn't record it at X Squared Radio because I was on the cell phone driving, and we covered the show from the road, which is fine. Now, as this survey was done, and keep in mind, this is a small sampling of space. We sampled a portion of the galaxy, they say, and it's based on these data. We can estimate overall numbers in the galaxy. Is it possible that they looked out there and just happened to find planets where they were looking and there aren't any planets everywhere else in the galaxy? Yes, it's possible, but not likely. Not likely. It's more likely that this sampling was pretty good and plus or minus a reasonable amount of probability. That's about how many planets are floating around out there. Now, the study led by Takahiro Sumi from Osaka University in Japan, in the southern part of Japan, appears in the May 19th issue of the journal Nature. The survey is not sensitive to planets smaller than Jupiter and Saturn, and the reason is, of course, that Jupiters are pretty hard to find. Saturns, Venuses, Earths, Mars-sized planets, impossible. Given the instrumentation that they were using and the amount of time that they were looking at each area and the amount of light that was gathered and the mathematical probabilities, they just could not nail down lighter planets. Are they there? Oh, you betcha. In our solar system, we have 8 or 9 planets. Depends on your school of thought. We have 1, Jupiter. Thank goodness. I will tell you, every successful solar system has a Jupiter. What do I mean by successful solar system? Well, solar systems are moving through space somewhere around 20 or 30 miles a second. While they're moving through space, there are other items that are moving through space, sometimes in an opposite direction, 20, 30, 40 miles a second, and collisions will occur. But large gravitational bodies act like giant vacuum cleaners for solar systems, and they suck up things like comets and asteroids and very small moons and things like that that might come floating through, because the gravitational field of Jupiter reaches out there quite a ways. So does our sun. And I would dare say most junk absorbed by Jupiter, absorbed by our sun, will absolutely be done in a harmless fashion. Relatively speaking, yes, it could be several hundred nuclear bombs worth of explosion when it hits that planet, but compared to the rest of the energy and mass of the planet, it's pretty darn small. Thank goodness, they're there, and we're out here, 93 million miles away from our sun, and we don't get hit very often. Thank goodness. Life can develop in all of its complexity and beauty and peace and tranquility, while things like Schumacher get sucked into Jupiter and explode on Primetime Live. That's how it works. The idea that there are free-floating Jupiters out there is a little disconcerting. That's not the kind of planet that could be absorbed by Jupiter or our sun without some catastrophic results. Previous observations spotted a handful of free-floating planet-like objects within star-forming clusters with masses three times that of Jupiter. These are very big planets. But scientists suspect the gaseous bodies from more like stars than planets. These small dim orbs called brown dwarfs grow from collapsing balls of gas and dust but lack the mass to ignite their nuclear fuel and shine with starlight. They just never turn into suns. Oh, they're dense enough. They just don't have the explosive power from lighting off and forming helium into hydrogen, because you really need a good amount of gravity to get that going. And so they just collapse into something far more dense than a planet, but approximately the size of a large planet. Dense as stars, but about the size of a large planet. On the other hand, it is likely that some planets are ejected from their early turbulent solar systems because sometimes stars get spinning too fast and they explode, or supernovas can occur far enough away where it doesn't actually consume the solar system, but close enough to where the wind or the energy blast from such an event could ripple space-time to the point where it strips the planets away from a sun, especially if they're held in a very tenuous orbit. And so they become free-floating. That's how Earth got here. We free-floated through space, and we landed in this orbit, and that's why we're around the star that we're around. Without a star to circle, these planets would move through the galaxy as our sun does, only it has all the planets moving with it. But our sun is basically a free-floating star in stable orbits around the galaxy's center. The discovery of 10 free-floating Jupiters supports the ejection scenario, though it's possible both mechanisms are at play. And there could be other things that just could be other things. They're absorbed by other galaxies. They're tugged out of place by various gravitational effects. I'll go on and quote him a little bit more. If free-floating planets formed like stars, then we would have expected to see only one or two of them in our survey instead of 10, Bennett said. Our results suggest that planetary systems often become unstable, with planets being kicked out from their places of birth. That makes a lot of sense. It also accounts for the very large numbers of these. The observations cannot rule out these possibilities. And when we're talking about quantum physics, we can extrapolate that to macro physics or space physics, except that in space physics we have the presence of gravity, where we would not have that in quantum levels. But the mathematics are generally the same. This is why Newton was accurately able, and Einstein, both accurately able to make predictions about the way bodies act in space, because these probabilities can be calculated and pretty closely, especially when we're talking about orbiting bodies. But we're talking about free-floating bodies. It's a little like trying to predict which way a steel ball is going to go when it's dropped into a pachinko machine. Hey, anything can happen. I mean, there are a lot of combinations. You got Jupiter tugging on it. You got gravitational forces. You got a solar wind. You have all kinds of three-dimensional, four-dimensional, and even five-dimensional forces that are working as these bodies move through space and warp space-time as they move. So a lot of this can have an effect on where a planet's going to go. That's what makes this body, if there is one, so interesting that's out there, which we now call Elenin. It's moving along the plane of the other planets in our solar system, which means that the mathematical probabilities are complicated because of the gravitational lines drawn or formed by these other planets in our solar system. Is it impossible to figure out where it's going to end up? No, it's not completely impossible, but as I said, we really don't have enough resolution. We don't have enough photographs. We don't have enough tracking information. Even if you go to JPL's website, it's a little iffy where that thing's going to end up. 0.236 solar or astronomical units from Earth, that's, 20 million miles. That's in the neighborhood, people. Let's see what the listeners have to say. Scott from California, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Good. It's Daytona Beach.
Hey, you were supposed
question,
to be in Florida.
Dr. Brooks.
What are you doing?
About Sagittarius there, you were talking about the Earth and so on and so forth. And I've heard this from another source. The same thing you said, that we were a part of Sagittarius and now we are a part of the Milky Way. And has that been a recent change, or is that something that's been over the thousands or billions of years? Or I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Yes, it's millions of years. When we look at, for instance, the evidence on the moon, which we didn't arrive here with the moon. The moon is separate from the Earth. Half the moon is covered with a black kind of iron dust, as is most of the large asteroids that are slow rotating in our solar system. Earth doesn't have that kind of event, not to the extent that the moon does. You look at the moon, it's pretty pockmarked, and it's small and not very gravitational. And it's been hit by some pretty large stuff. Large enough where it would have made an impact on Earth if we were in the neighborhood at the same time the moon was. That being said, if you look at the moon, the side that faces the Earth is generally coated with this black. And had these meteor strikes been recent, then you would see big white marks in the black, but you don't. The black generally covers, with the exception of some small white dots, generally covers the side of the moon that faces us. This kind of gives us a timeline. We don't think it's millions of years, maybe hundreds of thousands of years ago, that Earth ended up here, or at least in this solar system. Certainly Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, but not in this solar system.
Oh, so we're new to the neighborhood in terms of the solar system. I mean, it's not that the whole solar system came together. It's like our planet came separately. Is that the idea?
Yes.
Then? Okay.
Yes, there were a couple theories, and we really didn't have enough data to make a decision one way or the other. One was that Earth was here in this orbit, and Moon came along, and Earth captured it in its orbit. That's called the Earth capture theory, or the moon capture theory. And the other is that the moon was here, and this orbit was empty, and Earth came along and was captured by the moon, and that's called Earth capture theory. And that actually is the prevailing theory now.
Okay, and Sagittarius being the neighboring, I mean, it's not like, and it's not as far away from us as Andromeda. It's closer. It's more like intersecting with the Milky Way. Is that the idea, that it's or close by, or?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Because the way they portray it now in the astronomy books is that Andromeda is out there. You know, that's the next neighboring big galaxy. But Sagittarius is what, perpendicular then, or horizontal to Sagittarius being horizontal to the Milky Way.
Right.
Or
right, yeah.
Diagonal to, or whatever.
Well, if you look at the way that galaxy clusters revolve, and they form clusters and then superclusters, and these superclusters revolve around each other, the Sagittarius galaxy and the Andromeda galaxy move differently. It's evidence that the Sagittarius galaxy at one time passed through at least a portion of the Milky Way galaxy.
Okay. And one comment on last week's show. Jonah Bolt on Friday night, BBS Radio, his show comes on 11 o'clock Eastern Time, was talking about some of the latest statements made by Whole Foods, that their food bulk, that the bulk that they get, can no longer be assured to be non-GMO. And this is Whole Foods we're talking about, which is a major health food market throughout America. And now that information came out just 2 days ago, Friday night. in response
wow, that's
to what we
amazing.
Were talking about a week ago.
And interesting, this week, after we had the program, this week the news came out that scientists are ready to launch a new super GMO wheat. I know we had made mention in last Sunday's program that wheat was the only crop that really had not been addressed in a genetically modified form yet. And now they're talking about a genetically modified wheat that will have 15% higher yields. Well, you know, we have wheat growing land in this country that has been fallow since, what, 1964, 1970, when the CRP program was implemented. And since 1980, a lot of these farmers have been accepting checks. And then we just found out, because we talked to the daughter of one of these farmers actually lose control of their farm. Even if they hand the farm on to or sell the farm, the CRP goes with the land, not the farmer. They can never farm on that land again.
Canola oil, for example, I can speak from experience because I like to use it on my salad, but I only get the organic one from Spectrum. But even now, who's to say that's really organic? And, you know, I've noticed when I'm using the non-organic canola, my head will start to feel spacey. I can't concentrate. It does affect me. Canola, corn, cottonseed, and soy are supposedly the foremost genetically modified.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people don't know the extent of that genetic modification either. You know, we're not talking about just moving a few chiclets around on the gene, on the DNA. We're talking about bringing other plants and even animal DNA and sticking it into the DNA of the plant. We really don't know how many generations out we're going to start seeing super weeds and super insects and even biological effects on the beings that eat this stuff. You know, we might not see the results in one generation. It might take two or three or four generations to see it. But now we're starting to see this, you know, drug-resistant E. coli. We're starting to see, you know, sheep that eat, you know, young cotton plants and just die. That's never happened before.
Well, I'll get off here so others can talk. Thank you, Dr. Brooks.
You're very welcome, Scott. Thanks for coming on. Always a pleasure. And I, you know, I could make comments about CRP. Obviously, farmers were an independent lot, not prone to good business management. When the price of wheat would go up, they'd go out and plant like crazy, and they would drive the price of wheat down so low that nobody could make a profit. And so the government stepped in and said, that's it. We're going to limit the production of wheat so that we can keep the price, keep the supply and the demand where it needs to be. But people, that hasn't changed in more than 20 years. And yet the population of Earth has changed. We used to feed the world from here, and now we do not. Now we have people starving out there. And, you know, we've talked about it right here on this program, that we need to get America growing again. We need to be the ones that are feeding the world. We need to be replanting this land and getting it back into production again. That's something that's just powerful. This recent very, very expensive, very, very well-funded effort to gather up the oldest, rarest seeds, rice and every kind of organic, natural form of plant life that you can think of. Hundreds of varieties of rice, hundreds of varieties of wheat, of barley, of corn, of everything. And they're stored in a frozen vault up in the archipelago off the coast of Norway. It's a brilliant plan. It's a wonderful plan. It's a little isolated from the rest of the world. It's a little too much value in the hands of too few people. And one has to wonder, what really is the value of these genetically modified foods? Didn't nature do it well enough? Doesn't nature know how to make a corn kernel? Doesn't nature know how to make canola or cotton? Do we have to go in there and manipulate the genetics to make a better cotton plant, to make a better canola, to make a better corn, to make better soybeans? Do we really have to do that? Can't we just grow more? Can't the farmers just grow what they want, when they want, on whatever land they want? Isn't there another way to manage this? Or do we have to have global multinational corporations come in and tell us you could only grow the genetically modified foods? Do we have to have the mega corporations planting their plants next to our plants and then letting those genes blend into perfectly healthy natural plants and thus literally breeding out the natural plant forever? I don't think so. Anyway, I want to continue talking about free-floating planets because that's not the reason why we would jump down into bunkers and bury ourselves in the ground, city after city, nation after nation, to try to hide ourselves from whatever's going on up here on the surface. It would just seem to me that with all of the information that we're gaining, all of the discoveries that we're making, and the way that we're leaking it out to the public, we seem to be getting people ready for something. Have you seen a really good alien movie lately? Interesting. How about we listen to Letters from the Sky, Civil Twilight? By the way, if you saw the movie I Am Number 4, this is the song at the end of the movie. Listen closely to the words. We'll be back in about 4 minutes with more X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. welcome back to X Squared Radio. I will always come back for you. Don't worry about a thing. If you saw the movie I Am Number 4, that was the closing song of the movie. Third and final hour of X Squared Radio on June 12th. We are talking about free-floating planets and are the governments of the world getting us ready for some kind of contact, some kind of extraplanetary contact. We're spending money like there's no tomorrow. We're building shelters all over the world. We're spending a significant amount of the gross national product on building shelters, not for the large population of the United States, for the elite maybe, but some countries are beginning to build shelters for everyone. They want all their people to survive. By the way, this weekend the movie Super 8 came out. Another in a long list of movies about aliens who have been captured and studied and probed and held on this planet against their will, who have busted out at all cost to regain their freedom and launch their way back out into space, home, so to speak. And I'm impressed with the way this film was directed. Of course, Spielberg always does a great job at directing. I am really impressed with the young cast of this movie, largely unknowns. If they have been in any other production, I don't know what it is. They're too young to have a really long film career, but I'm sure they're going to have one now. Just really well done. I was really impressed with the movie. I know it's going to be number one. This survey that was done about these extra planets, these Jupiter-like planets that are out there. You know, previous observations of bound planets tell us only about planets which are surviving in orbits now, like Earth and like our planets around our sun. The lead author of this study, whose name is Takiro Sumi of Osaka University in Japan, he says that, however, these findings inform us how many planets have formed and scattered out. There are alien worlds under a gravitational lens. Sumi and his colleagues made the find using a method called gravitational microlensing, which watches what happens when a massive object passes in front of a star from our perspective on Earth. Now, you got to be pretty lucky, folks, if a planet just happens to pass in front of a point of light out there. It's sort of like somebody walking in front of the movie screen. You're going to be able to tell how big that person is based on how much light it blocks on the screen. The nearby object bends and magnifies the light from the distant star, acting like a lens. This produces a light curve, a brightening and fading of the faraway star's light over time, whose characteristics tell astronomers a lot about the foreground object's size and also its density. The more dense it is, the more it can bend light. In many cases, this nearby body is a star. If it has any orbiting planets, these can generate secondary light curves, alerting researchers to their presence. Before the current study, astronomers had used the gravitational microlensing technique to discover a dozen or so of the nearly 550 known planets. This is since the Kepler mission, and they've detected 1,235 candidate planets by a different method, but they still need to be confirmed by follow-up observations. Sumi and his team looked at 2 years worth of data from a telescope in New Zealand, which was monitoring 50 million Milky Way stars for microlensing events. That's not very much of space, by the way. They identified 474 such events, including 10 that lasted less than 2 days. Now that's pretty good. That's a pretty good shot of space. These free-floating planets are the ones that are really interesting to us because, like, running down the highway with your headlights able to see just so far ahead, and then all of a sudden, boom, there's a deer in the road. Well, you might have a little bit of time to slam on the brakes or curse or swerve, but what if the deer moves? I mean, it could be catastrophic for your car, and hopefully the darn thing doesn't jump in the air and come through the windshield. In any case, there's going to be a collision. There's going to be some deer meat on the table somewhere because of that event. And that's what we might be facing, because our headlights only look out there so much. They can only see so far. They can only see so far on either side of the road. Somewhere out there could be a body floating through space. The mathematics are there. The odds are there. The probabilities are there. Let's see what our listeners have to say about this. Let's see. Joe from Idaho, back on line one. Welcome to you.
Brooks, I'm sorry to bother you again, but it goes into exactly the discussion on what the government is preparing for. And I wanted to just play a clip. It was Don Nikoloff on BBS, had it on his radio show about a month ago or so, and he was saying he thought that this had been in the last week that Congress had, that the House of Representatives had voted on this bill, but it hadn't been, because I've had this clip, a congressional record from C-SPAN, for about a year now. So if you'll let me, I want to play this clip, and it addresses specifically at the end of this clip underground shelters. And as soon as you verify that you heard it okay, I'll get off the phone and you can tell us your view on this, if you could.
Okay. How long is the clip?
It's not very long. It's like a minute or something like that.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, I'm going to get this up to a speaker and let you hear this. This is really quite amazing because...
Congress shall now vote for approval of H.R. 8791, the Homeland Terrorism Preparedness Bill. Said bill requests emergency response funding up to and including, this section is classified, dollars to prepare for national level terrorist attack and or attacks from classified. Funding for first responder personnel and vehicles would be doubled if said attack leads to more than 80% of national population being affected by...
Yeah, I can hear that. So, I don't know. I think generally speaking, a lot of this is conspiracy theory stuff. Specifically speaking, there is no question that the government is spending a lot of money building shelters. Some in this country, a lot in other countries. Why? You think really it's because we're playing a lot of alien movies on sci-fi channels and in the movies? I don't think so. How accurate are some of these reports and some of these recordings? I don't know. You know, we try to vet all of our sources here, and I really appreciate Joe. I appreciate his zeal and his ability to listen to what's being broadcast out there. I can't verify this source, and so I wasn't going to play the rest of this on the program, and I appreciate Don being attentive on that. What I really want to hear is your thoughts, your ideas on what you think is the possibility that these free-floating planets are possibly presenting a threat to our solar system, and are the powers that – I was going to say the powers that be. Don't ever let me say that on this program. Please call me and say, Brooks, you just said the powers that be. Whenever you have a screenplay and you write it and you go get a star and you get a director, somewhere along the line, somebody has to raise the money. And usually that money has to be pretty well guaranteed. It's got to be have a good knowledge that film is going to make money or that people are going to listen to it. But there also has to be an assurance there aren't going to be any ramifications from airing that film. And I'm always amazed at the quality, that is to say the qualities of the alien movies that we're seeing now, whether it's Skyline or whether it's Super 8 or whether it's the different alien movies that we're seeing now. They're not like E.T. They're not like the movies that made us feel good, made us wonder about exploring space. They're following a similar theme, and I don't know what they're getting us ready for, but it's interesting. Now, the individual I'm going to bring on the program right now hasn't been on the program before, but I trust his research impeccably. I have vetted a couple of his sources. I've studied it in careful detail, and what you are about to hear is going to be absolutely earth-shaking. And there's more evidence to come. I'm not ready to divulge it to you yet, but over time, we will. Keep in mind, we're going to take this one step at a time. I want to introduce to you Antonin Fiore. Welcome to the program.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you, Dr. Agnew, for taking my call. But I, you must have switched to the wrong line, because the person you were alluding to clearly isn't me. So should I go to the other line and wait for you to take that call?
Oh, no, you're good. You're good. Okay. We just made a change. We've got some information that particular recording was not congressional, and we just try to have nothing but authentic sources on the program if we can.
That's very well said. And you know, for the caller who shared that clip, I'd just like to say thanks for the passion. But for folks that might come across a clip of that nature also on YouTube in the future, you'll notice that in the lower right hand, I believe, else it's the lower left hand corner of the screen, the logo is a mocked up representation of the C-SPAN logo, which is why it's so misleading. It seems credible, because the hoax, the forgery was. Well, I hate to say the term quality craftsmanship, but they placed a lot of effort into it, clearly. So, whenever folks are coming across that sort of content, particularly on YouTube, always try to be very mindful about some of the cues that you're seeing on the screen, because sometimes that can be your signal as to its either its providence and or its veracity.
Well, we also look for known sources. We use Fox News, we use CNN, we use C-SPAN, but I got to recognize the person that's in the screen. I got to make sure that I can cross-reference that person to make sure that it's a legitimate source.
Certainly. Absolutely. Fully agreed. Well, Dr. Agnew, the purpose for my call, I had to step away, and I unfortunately had to miss the first portion of your broadcast, but I'm going to pick it up on the archives as soon as it's ready. I joined in listening probably about the last 10 minutes prior to your break. And I first want to say thank you so much for sharing that clip also, the music clip from the soundtrack. Very poignant, no?
Yes, and, I think and so.
Sorry, go ahead.
The words are really powerful. I heard the song about a year ago, and I read the lyrics to it, and I went, wow, that's really powerful stuff. And then when I saw the movie I Am Number 4, and I saw it used in the soundtrack as really not just a cover-up, but an important part of the movie, I thought, wow, this the passion with which this three-man group plays this very powerful piece of poetry is really pertinent, and I enjoyed it.
Absolutely, absolutely, and thank you for sharing that, with us. I feel like it's kind of a bit of a look inside the heart of Dr. Agnew at the same time, and so I very much appreciate that you shared that with us. And I do have to apologize if my closing thought is something that you've already covered earlier in the program, but with regard to these releases of movies and the extraterrestrial theme, if you've already mentioned these next two that I'm about to mention, again, my apologies, but there are two films. One is called... I believe it's called Another Earth, and you can see the trailer clips for that film, on the web. It should be easily accessible, the trailer clips. And then also The Tree of Life, the production that has Brad Pitt and Sean Penn. I'm not sure if you're familiar with either of those films, but if folks check out the trailers that are available, on the web, you're going to see a very strong theme. In the case of another Earth, it, I believe what we're really dealing with is a free-floating planet that's captured in Earth's gravitational field. And I think that the twist there is this a parallel Earth? In other words, are there, kind of going back to Niels Bohr and his, physics and work, is it a parallel Earth, a parallel reality that each of us are represented on? And then the other film, The Tree of Life, I think the arc of the film is built around Sean Penn's character and what he experiences internally from childhood to adult. It follows an arc that's parallel to some kind of celestial object, which is making its way toward our sun, certainly, is the implication from the trailer clips. In either case, I am desperately eager to watch both of these films. And in the case of The Tree of Life, I know it's out there. I'm in L.A. now, so I'm pretty hopeful that I'm going to be able to find a theater where I can see it, because I know back home I'll probably not see it until it's out on video.
Yeah, I haven't seen the trailer for either one of these movies, but I think, both of those artists are really good. I don't know who the directors are, if this is going to be, more of a drama or a sci-fi, I don't know. But I think both of those are very powerful themes. And I just submitted a screenplay myself for the three books, The Ark of Millions of Years series, with kind of an over-twist of Remembering the Future, the physics of the soul and time travel laid in there. It's a really, really powerful idea. It certainly lends itself to a higher level of, I want to call it, not science fiction, but science possibility in film.
Yes.
When the movie Knowing came out, I thought that was really going to get people thinking, because that talks about the possibility of a solar conflagration and why other beings from other worlds would come here and try to seed other worlds with people from our planet. I thought it was a powerful theme, and I thought Nicolas Cage did a marvelous job in that movie.
I fully concur. I absolutely agree. Well, Dr. Agnew, I know that you've got a lot of a host of topics you've probably yet to address, and also some folks probably interested to get in. So I just want to thank you again for helping me out a little earlier in the day, and then also for taking my call now. I sure appreciate listening to your show.
Yes, absolutely. We talked about Antonin Fiore. He's got a new program called The Crimson Pill. It's on BBS Radio on a Sunday earlier in the afternoon. And we encourage all X-Squared Radio listeners to tune in. Antonin, he's going to go far. I can guarantee you that.
You're very kind. Brooks, thank you again so much. Hopefully we'll be in touch very soon.
Same here, my friend. Have a wonderful week. May it be productive and peaceful. My friends, what we're talking about tonight are the possibilities, the quantum possibilities of free-floating planets in space. We have offered a plethora of evidence that it's not a small number of planets, as was once thought, that we're talking about dozens of Jupiter-sized planets in a very, very small area of space. Certainly the probability that these Jupiter-sized planets exist in larger numbers all over space in areas much closer than 10,000 light years away. The reason that these Jupiter-sized planets are the ones that are being reported upon is because, well, they're easy to see through this magnetic lensing methods that were used by Mr. Sumi during his studies at Osaka University. These are the kinds of planets that would have that kind of lensing effect because they have enough gravity to do so. But that also means that, these micro-lensing techniques that are used, whether they're used on stars or whether they're used on planets, are missing a lot of the smaller planets, Earth-sized planets, Mars-sized planets. I once thought that a planet has to have a sun around which to orbit in order to have enough energy to support life. Generally, I still think that's true. But as a planet floats through space, if it has no external form of energy, nothing is pouring infrared energy onto that planet, eventually, that planet's going to freeze. The exterior of that planet's going to freeze, And then down through the crust, the permafrost will go deeper and deeper and deeper. The occupants of that planet will be forced deeper and deeper and deeper underground. It's happened. We've had ice ages on this planet, and men went underground. They lived in caves, and they effectively survived for generations until the planet became warm and green again on the surface. We know what happens. Our planet's tilted a mere 23 degrees on its axis. And it doesn't take long. I mean, winter, the middle of winter is December 21st. And by January 21st, it's pretty darn cold here in the Northern Hemisphere. By the time you get, as far north as Kansas, you're going to be at 20, 30, 40 below zero. Well, people, if the sun doesn't come back up, the snow isn't going to melt. It's going to stay 40 below zero. And if there's no sun at all, it stays 40 below zero in the Northern Hemisphere as summer ends in the Southern Hemisphere and never comes back. It doesn't take long. Yes, there's probably enough energy to survive. We can, with our technology, we can melt snow and make water, and we can have hydroponic gardens, but eventually, over hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, there will not be enough energy left on a free-floating planet to support life on the surface. We'll have to go underground, where the uranium engine, the white-hot iron core of the Earth, may keep it warm enough, long enough to sustain life for a few thousand years, to where we can get around another sun and start melting the snow on the surface of the world and get our liquid oceans back. It could happen. Larger planets, because of what's called tidal forces, that is to say the wobbling of the core or the movement of magma underneath in geothermal fashion, could keep a planet warm for thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years. But smaller planets the size of Earth with what we call 1G, where you weigh what you weigh now, not that much energy is going to be available on a planet like that. If you lived on Jupiter, well, you wouldn't live on Jupiter because your bones would be crushed by your own body weight. You would weigh so much that you would just flatten out. The atmosphere would be so dense that you wouldn't be able to survive. Planets a little larger than Earth, could you survive if you weighed 300 pounds or 400 pounds? It's possible that you could develop enough muscle to support yourself, but just as the dinosaurs did not last on this planet because their body weight would not allow them to walk the lands of our world very long before arthritis and bone decay would just literally waste them away. They just wouldn't live long enough. If it wasn't for a lack of natural enemies and a prolific breeding program, there wouldn't have been dinosaurs at all. They just wouldn't have been able to survive that large. The fact that some of them could relieve their body weight by floating around in the water is a testament to their ability to adapt, as the hippopotamus is, as other animals are that support their immense weight in the water. Stay enough time in the water and you won't need legs anymore. You may become like a whale, although there are a lot of whales that still have the remnants of their legs as they once walked the earth. They spend so much time in the water, you don't need legs anymore. So, but the bone structure is still there. If you notice, their appendages are gone, but the bone structure, the hips and everything, are still inside those animals, and many of them still display the ability to walk on land. Now, we've had some breakthroughs in astrobiology. Astrobiology is historically focused on liquid water as the habitable liquid. And certainly it works well on Earth. It makes sense to us. You know, you get a little bit of pond water and, hey, you can have life. But it doesn't necessarily have to be water. It can be liquid methane. And we've got moons right in our own solar system that have oceans of methane. We have Titan. And we have other moons on the planet that use methane as a liquid media. And it's organic. Come on, it's CH3, carbon and hydrogen. You add a little bit of oxygen and you can get CO2 and And you've got the makings of respiration. No, it isn't the way we're used to it with an oxygen and two hydrogens, but it is basically the same kind of chemistry, just a little different slant. I kind of like the idea because it means that their form of life can't come here and take over our world because obviously we're oxygen-based and we like a dip in a good salt or fresh water. They wouldn't be able to survive such things. Water would be way too acidic for their means of existence. And, you know, of course, researchers have calculated that we need what's called an M3 planet to be able to survive. The idea that you have to have a wet planet, you have to have a liquid media to survive, could be outdated. It may not be necessary. You may not have to live on the surface of the planet. Maybe you can live a meter underneath the planet, 2 meters, 10 meters, a mile underneath the crust. Conditions could be right to support life. Maybe there's an idea, and it's well supported, that planets don't form as solid balls, and they actually don't. I mean, we realize our planet is even solid. If you swing one way in the geological theory, we're a molten planet with a solid core, and we float around on it like cornflakes in a bowl of milk. On another model, we have a thick crust, to be sure, that's certainly tectonically active. It's certainly got a lot of magma in it, but inside of that is a void, and between that void and the core is a space around which, you know, it forms a dielectric, which creates the magnetic field that we call our magnetosphere. That theory still holds water. There's not enough evidence to rule it out. It's a possibility. It is a possibility. We have a number of instruments that we're sending into space. Okay, let's see if I can find this here. Oh, yes, we're getting ready to explore Europa as the next flagship mission to the outer solar system. And maybe decades before another, you know, major mission flies off to Saturn or Titan, but on a smaller scale and less expensive lander known as the Titan Mar Explorer. Titan Maze Explorer. Sorry, the type is just a little bit too small. Let me see if I can increase that. Oh, that's a lot better. The Titan Mare Explorer could launch as early as 2015, arriving in 2022 or 2023. Ellen Stofan of Proxime Research in Rectortown, Virginia, the principal investigator for the TIME mission, described the lander as a buoy-shaped capsule that would splash down in one of Titan's northern lakes and float across its surface for a minimum of 2 Titan days, which is about 16 Earth days. She goes on to say, we have a number of instruments on board. The most important from a pure scientific point of view is a mass spectrometer. Just to give you an idea what a mass spectrometer is, it is able to measure the molecular weight of a compound by magnetically pulling it into a detector. It sort of slams the detector, and it can tell based on the amount of weight with which it hits the detector and the frequency that's used to attract it electromagnetically, it can determine what the molecular weight is, whether it's 18 or 32 or 64. And by that molecular weight, it has a probability of compounds that it could be. That's what a mass spectrometer does. Now, you need a little bit more information to be able to tell exactly what compound it is, because obviously a lot of compounds have exactly the same molecular weight. You would need a different kind of spectrometer, one that volatilizes that molecule in some way or shines a laser at it where we can see which bonds vibrate at what frequency and thus absorbing some of that laser energy. And we can tell by that absorption frequency exactly what molecular bond we're talking about. And with a good scan of that, we should be able to make a good guess on what the compound is. That is a lot more sophisticated instrument for now, a mass spectrometer could be good, because what you really want to know is how much of that sea is methane, how much is ethane, how much is propane. That would be an interesting information to know. She goes on to say, we'll take basically a sip of the liquid lake several times and analyze these sips to really nail down their chemical compositions. We know there's methane, that's CH3. We know there's ethane, that has two carbons. It's fully saturated because of the A-N-E ending, ethane instead of ethene, which means as many hydrogens as possible are on that compound. Two carbons, six hydrogens. We know there's ethane, but time would inventory more complex organic hydrocarbon compounds as well, such as propane, and maybe there might even be a propanol, some kind of alcohol present on that as well. If there is life on Titan, it may be difficult to detect because respiration might be in a different form. We don't know what the waste products would be, but it could be possible. Be kind of interesting to see a methane fish, I think. She goes on to say, I don't expect you to go to these lakes and see beautiful filamentary structures made of cells that are macroscopic in size or easily seen. That also would be called a fish, I think. Says Lunin, who is a co-investigator of the proposed time mission. The clues could be subtle. We would have to look for particular peculiarities in the composition, hydrocarbons that are lacking that should be there, others that are more abundant than expected, and some of these hydrocarbons could be sugars, they could be fats, they could be amino acids. All of these are hydrocarbons. No one knows what happens to organic chemistry in Titan's environment. In fact, no one really knows what happens in organic chemistry. When I took organic chemistry, it's kind of a rough science. Yields are somewhat statistical. They're not exact. Organic chemistry doesn't do the same thing every single time. We try to get it to do that. Even in polymer chemistry, we try to drive things one way or the other. But all kinds of things affect which way it's going to go. The presence of all the reactants, the pressure, the temperature, the amount of energy that's in the system, what wavelength that energy might be, if it's X-rays or if it's light or if it's infrared or sound, all of that has an effect on what organic chemistry, what kind of organic chemical reactions take place. Not so much in inorganic chemistry. We kind of know how to make steel the same way every single time, but come on, apple pie doesn't come out the same way every time. That's just the way of organic chemistry, I'm afraid. Does it go to a kind of chemistry that we can call life? That remains to be seen. What would we call life? Doesn't have to be something self-aware with a language and a number system. It could be something as simple as a single-celled animal. It could be something as simple as a virus. And it could be something as complex as a multi-celled animal where various cells have special specialties that allow it to share responsibility for the total organism, a little bit like the biological transducer in which we live. And there's a possibility that it could be intelligent, self-aware. That would be interesting. In fact, that would be revolutionary. It'd be fascinating to be sure. Because if the answer is yes, it means that the origin of life has either taken place more than once or it has spread further than we can imagine. It also means a common outcome of planetary processes in the cosmos. If the answer is yes, well, then we're not alone. And the idea that there could be a rogue planet out there floating through space, a recent orphan from a distant star, and it has life on it. It has intelligent life. It has cities and a system of beings who have learned to live within the ecosystem of their planet in such a way that they can draw energy from the core of the planet up to the surface of the planet and be able to survive for millennia until they do find a sun or they do find another planet onto which they can migrate, then life gets very interesting indeed. In fact, it looks a little bit like the story told on the Pakal tomb lid in the area of Palenque in South America. It tells a very similar story as one called Earth that exists on the outer limb of the Milky Way. Very interesting. Out of the deep vagina of the galaxy called the Rift in the Milky Way comes a free-floating planet with life on it, floating on a ship full of samples of life from their previous existence around a distant star. And as it comes to rest in a distant solar system orbiting around a sun, that ship comes to rest on dry land. The occupants emerge and meet the neighbors. It's happened before. It's not only recorded in the book of Genesis, it's recorded in stone, in areas of the planet that never even knew an area called Jerusalem existed. It has been speculated that Earth-like rogue planets could have very thick atmospheres that keep them relatively warm, or moons of giant rogue planets that could experience tidal heating. Tidal heating is a little bit like kneading a ball of dough. The energy that's used to squeeze and stretch that planet back and forth as it revolves on its axis and as it's close enough to a gravitational origin like Jupiter or some large planet, some dense body like that. That squishing back and forth of the crust could generate enough heat to keep the surface relatively habitable. The oceans might be beneath an icy surface, but they would be liquid nonetheless because of this tidal heating. And we're not the first to think of this. No, no. Planetary scientist Heikki Van Hamacki at the Finnish Meteorological Institute in Helsinki also agrees with that. Planet hunters have used a variety of methods to detect the indirect effects extrasolar planets have on their host stars. Obviously, we've talked about this perturbation that these planets can have on their host stars. But if they're floating through space and they have thick atmospheres and they have a lot of energy on the inside of them, maybe they're a young planet. Maybe they have a lot of molten material in their magma. They can exist for a long time, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, supporting life as they move through space without external help from the sun. Yes, it would be cold on the surface, but people could live underneath the surface. And if they were intelligent enough to be able to travel to other worlds, they could be populating as they go, spreading their race and their information and their legacy as they move through the galaxy on their ship-like planet. Kind of interesting. Kind of interesting indeed. We haven't actually seen a sci-fi movie of that. But as we opened up this program tonight, we were talking about governments spending money to develop underground shelters for people to hide in or to survive in while things on the surface of the planet became a little messy. They could get messy because if one of these Jupiter-sized planets, doesn't have to be that big to tell you the truth, passes close enough to Earth, you realize that the moon is 1/6 the mass of the Earth. It revolves around our planet once every 28 days. It also rotates the same rate on its own axis, so the same side of the moon always faces us. But it's a little bitty thing out there traveling 250,000 miles away from Earth. And look what it does to our oceans. Look what it does to the tectonic activity of our own planet, the earthquakes, the movement of tides, the effect on biology. As we go moon to moon, it was so powerful that the Maya used it to design the calendar. They didn't ignore the sun, but they measured time in terms of moons. The moon itself does have a gravitational effect on the Earth. Tides in the very northern and very southern latitudes go up and down several dozen feet. In the more temperate areas of the planet, it doesn't go up and down that much. In the equatorial areas, you hardly have any tides at all. Southern California has a tide of, 6 or 8 feet, not very much. And as you go further south, the tides get lower and lower and lower. But if you get a planet the size of Jupiter, you get a planet the size of Venus that comes floating through the neighborhood, and now you're talking about something that could pull an ocean around to one side of the planet, several hundred or even several thousand feet thick. That means that you would have a tide that would be lapping up against the San Bernardino Mountains on the West Coast. You would have a tide that would completely cover most of the Hawaiian Islands. You have a tide that would make the state of Florida completely disappear. Would it be a storm surge? Sort of, except there probably wouldn't be a storm to go with it per se. But you would have a tide that would be catastrophic. Much like the generators that existed at the Japanese nuclear power plant in Japan, I don't think that an underground shelter would actually do that much good in a case like that. I definitely wouldn't want to be in an underground shelter in Miami. Maybe an underground shelter up in the Appalachian Mountains. Maybe an underground shelter in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado or the Cascades of Northern California. But I don't think I'd want to be in an underground shelter in Washington, D.C., not without a really good water pump. The whole thing's liable to be underwater, quite a bit of water. The odds are there. The idea is there. The fact that NASA is getting its own employees ready, the observation that sci-fi is preparing us not to meet E.T. with its friendly, healing, glowing finger, and maybe not with its brain-eating, violence of movies like Skyline or something like that, but it's getting us ready for something. The movies that are getting the money and reaching the screen are not necessarily the movies that you particularly demand running to the post, the box office to buy your tickets, because there are other alien stories that would sell just as well. We love the fantasies like Star Wars. We love the exploratory methods of Star Trek. But what do you think it could be? Do you think it's the brain-eating aliens that are feeding upon the fear of humankind? Do you think it's the explorer that's out there trying to find a wonderful green blue planet like Earth upon which to have its summer vacations? Do you think it's mankind needing another frontier to move out to expand the possibilities for the human race? What do you think? Give us a call. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. We can get a couple of phone calls in. The phone number here, if you're off planet, 530-413-4511. I'd love to know what you're thinking. If you're west of Earth, 530-413-4515. And if you're east of Earth, 530-413-4520. I know if I was thinking about it, and gosh, I think I am because I'm the one talking, I think that the possibilities are endless. I think that humans are a naturally exploring race. We have to climb mountains. We have to swim seas. We have to see if we can fly. We have to keep looking further and further out into space. We're driven to it. It's our nature. Are we looking for a catastrophe? Are we succumbing? Are governments succumbing to the fear of the unknown, wanting to bury themselves in the earth while those that are less prepared, the hungry masses of the earth, are wiped clean from the surface the way some conspiracy theorists think? Do you think we need to prepare? Do you think we need to get some food together, some water together, a safe place to go, a plan, the way NASA is talking about for its own employees and whose training videos are now going viral all over the internet, ostensibly in a vicarious way, getting us ready for some kind of global catastrophe that's getting ready to come? Do you think it's an earthquake? Do you think it's a global superstorm? Do you think it's an ice age? Interesting stuff. We're just now getting ready to start the hurricane season. I can tell you that 2011 has been a record of records. 2010, we saw more than 3 months over 90 degrees in the southeast. Immediately after that, we had the earliest snows on record. Now we've had record snows in the west. Snows on Memorial Day in the mountains. Snows in Hawaii in June. We've had some very strange extremes going on our planet. We've had a record number of tornadoes the last 2 months. We've had rumblings on the New Madrid Fault. We've had floods beyond proportion. Things that we thought we were prepared for. South Dakota is being evacuated as we speak. They're getting ready to tear down a dam because the water is flowing over it at the rate of more than 50 miles an hour. Is Earth having an allergic reaction to the activities of man? Or is there some gravitational body out there, somewhere, not emitting light, but having its effects? And the officials know about it, and they're not telling us. Just interesting questions for thought. As we prepare ourselves, as we stretch our telescopes, our minds, our imaginations out into space to get ourselves ready. Ask yourselves, ask your higher self if you want to, what's going on? Why are all the trucks running around? Why are all the dollars being spent in the way they're being spent? Interesting stuff. Might not hurt to get a tent, a bicycle, and give our friends down at 1-800-PREPARE.com a call. Go to their website. See what you can do to get yourself prepared. We'll have a little more information next week. There's some great stuff. I don't think we're heading toward Armageddon. I don't think there's any brain-eating aliens on their way here. But something's coming. because the governments of the world are spending their money, getting themselves ready. I think it's maybe time to not sit around on the beach and watch everybody get ready. There are operations going on around us. I promise you this, when this picture is available for us of the whereabouts of Elenin, you'll be the first to know. As soon as I get that information in my hands, I will vet it. I will make sure that it's real and accurate, and then I will share it with you. We'll see you next week, right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.